Some of you may have heard that. There are a few people here today that are already supporters of the Urban Air Initiative. So I'd like to just get this started. I kind of wanted to start with just some interesting facts, because I think the ethanol industry has seen this this market before, but not in any one of our lifetimes. I find it interesting that in 1923, 100 million gallons of ethanol was available for the motor fuel vehicles. Europe led the U.S. in more ethanol in their gasoline because of less obstruction from the oil industry. But I also find it interesting that a gentleman by the name of Thomas Megley, who discovered tetraethyl lead in 1921, had patented mid-level blends of ethanol in 1920. And in fact, he was noted for driving around his car on E30, promoting E30 prior to the patents of lead of 1921. Unfortunately, though, GM and DuPont owned the patents, and Thomas Megley suffered from lead poisoning and had to move to Florida. And everyone in the refinery, the first refinery for tetraethyl lead, died of lead poisoning in an accident in the mid-20s. So the oil industry doesn't have a pretty good reputation on that aspect. What's also of interest is Henry Ford and Thomas Edison were huge supporters of mid-level blends, and when API started in 1919, you can see that API has a long history of criticizing ethanol. In fact, in the 1930s, API went after Henry Ford for his support of E30 over using lead. So I guess API has a long history of being pretty effective at attacking our industry. So I just want to introduce the Urban Air Initiative a little bit. It was formed 2 years ago, but I think our research, our data, has gone back 4 to 5 years ago. We've started a lot of octane research with the autos. Our very first one study was published over 2 years ago. So we have a very technical approach to the message and the mission of the Urban Air Initiative. The Urban Air Initiative is a nonprofit organization, and we are dedicated to the reducing emissions, toxic emissions, primarily from aromatics, and to improve public health. And I think especially from the technical view, the mid-level blends of ethanol or ethanol in general is the most optimal way of reducing the toxic emissions, but it also requires us to understand how to gain access to the market. UAI also has a very strong educational approach to this. I will talk about that after Mr. Palmer does his presentation, just a little bit more of what we're doing on consumer education and the additional websites that we're putting up. So we've asked Michael, Todd Palmer, to help us understand some of the legal challenges. And we are really focused on the issues of aromatics and gasoline. 25% of gasoline today is some form of aromatics. It is the key component of gas that damages hoses, seals, gaskets, carbon deposits, carbon emissions, oil dilution. So it is the worst component of gasoline. All right, so you're going to hear a lot more today about the endangerment of vapor pressure, and some education on why the FFE credits are so important. So at this time, I'm going to turn it over to Todd Palmer. He is with the Michael Best law firm, both in Wisconsin and in Madison, or in Wisconsin and in D.C., and he is going to present and provide some very complex issues that UAI feels is vitally important to opening the access for the market. So at this time, I'd like to introduce Todd. So come on up.
I'm a walker, so sometimes that bothers people, but I kind of pace when I do this type of thing, so please forgive me. I was asked to give a little bit of background about myself. There is a bio for me in the materials that were distributed to you. I'm not going to go through that. But in terms of my experience, I have been a lawyer now for over 20 years. I practice almost exclusively in the area of environmental law. And much of that has been focused on Clean Air Act regulation. Prior to going to law school, I worked for an environmental engineering firm. So throughout my entire professional life, I've really been assisting companies in navigating environmental regulations in one form or another. Like any other lawyer, I provide regulatory advice and litigation representation to my clients. But I'm somewhat unique in that I'm also a registered lobbyist. I do work on behalf of various industrial sectors, trying to find ways to improve regulations and statutes to allow them to operate more efficiently, more profitably in the context of a pretty complex environmental structure that's regulatory structure that's out there. As had been mentioned a moment ago, we were contacted by, looks like I lost the president, there we go. We were contacted by UAI about 6 months ago to take a look at all the technical information that they've been pulling together, look at their goals for the organization, and then also to look at some of the other ethanol advocacy that's going on in this space, and provide them with some ideas on how they may be a little bit more effective in getting their goals accomplished. And we gave them quite a few ideas. I'm going to go through some of those here with you in a moment, take about a half an hour or so. But I want to say before I get into that, I'm firmly convinced that if these advocacy activities that I'll mention in a moment are undertaken, I do believe that it would pose probably the best chance for UAI to achieve the goals that they've set forth for their organization. And simultaneously, as we'll explain in a minute, I think that it would lift the tide, so to speak, for this entire industry. The agenda that we set forth for UAI and the advocacy approach that we're recommending really is focused at creating a regulatory environment that I think would very much favor your industry and allow you to see the value of your product in the marketplace, removing many of the regulatory structures and impediments that you have to deal with here today with the EPA. So, as I mentioned, I'm going to spend about a half an hour, and I'm going to walk you through a couple things. I'm going to start with just a general overview, some background information I want to provide to you to make sure we're all on the same page, then talk a little bit more detail as to what the Urban Air Initiative is, what their goals are, what their plan will be to achieve those goals, talk about some of their advocacy approaches that we've recommended, and then put that in the context of the legal and regulatory structure that this will need to be presented in. At the end, I'm going to hand it back over to Steve, and he has a few more words about what UAI is doing, and then we'll open it up for questions. I'll be around as well for a couple hours after this presentation, so feel free to approach me if you'd like to talk about any of these. So I always find it very helpful to begin these types of presentations, if you're looking at a very complex topic, to first start with a general overview of what it is that you're proposing or what it is that you're trying to communicate. It's much like going on a long car trip. You know, if you go on Google Maps or something and you put in the destination, instead of going to the turn-by-turn directions immediately, typically, at least I do, I go to the big picture, try to figure out where I'm going and how I'm going to get there, big picture, and then I drill into the details, and I'm going to follow that model here today. So in a nutshell, UAI, as Steve mentioned, is an organization, a nonprofit organization, that's focused on improving air quality and human health, primarily in urban environments. And the way they're doing that is by improving the quality of fuels. As he had mentioned, the way to do that is focusing on aromatic compounds that are added to gasoline to boost its octane rating. What is different, at least in my mind, as far as UAI's approach, is they're looking at an advocacy approach that would be more collaborative with the EPA. And the way to do that is to appeal to organizations and public interest groups that have not historically focused on the ethanol industry or renewable fuels. The way to do that is to really emphasize the health benefits associated with removing aromatic or limiting aromatic compounds that are added as an octane additive to fuels, and the benefits that would be realized if ethanol were used as a replacement. So that's the overall goal and the overall strategy. There's obviously some nuances to that, and we'll get to those in a moment, but that's the general overview of what this plan entails. We start digging into the details. I think it's important to start with just a little bit of background, and I suspect that many of you in this audience already know this about Octane, but I also suspect there's some folks here in the audience that aren't as familiar, so I want to make sure we're on the same page. In my mind, I believe the marketplace values gasoline by one metric, and that would be octane content. And the reason I say that is if you go to my mom, who is a pretty good indication of what the public is like, and you ask her, you know, what's out there in the marketplace in terms of fuel, she'd be like, I don't know. I go to the pump, and there's three buttons that I can push. One says 87, one's 89, one's 91. Dad tells me that's octane, and octane's a good thing. And I know the higher octane fuels are more expensive. That's the metric, folks, at least in my mind, in the general public. And I think the petroleum refiners realize that, and they see that there's value associated with octane. And as Steve had mentioned, back since the 1920s, they've been trying to find a low-cost octane additive that would allow them to increase the value of their fuels. And of course, they started with lead. We know that. And up until the 50s and 60s, when the hazards of lead started becoming very evident by organizations similar to UAI, there was an advocacy approach and coalitions formed that pressured Congress into passing the 1970 version of the Clean Air Act that really had one purpose, and that was to phase out lead. Ever since then, the refiners have been trying to find a replacement for lead. They've looked at manganese. That had some problems associated with it. MTBE was an octane enhancer. We know that that had problems with it. It had caused groundwater contamination. So they had to keep moving on. Today, they've pretty much settled on aromatics, and we'll talk about that in more detail in a moment. But importantly, in 1990, Congress recognized what was going on here, and they made a decision that they couldn't continue to try to police these additives that were going into gasoline, and it would be, from a public policy standpoint, it would be better for them to cede that authority and that decision-making down to the EPA. So in 1990, they amended the Clean Air Act, and they gave EPA the power to regulate and out-and-out ban additives in gasoline if it could be established that those additives caused or contributed to an endangerment to public health or welfare. And that's a phrase that we'll revisit in a moment. I'll end with that because that's the legal trigger that we're looking at here for UAI as being the mechanism for advancing some of these technical, scientific, and health issues that we're going to talk about in a moment. EPA has used that endangerment criteria in a variety of different contexts. For those of you that follow Clean Air Act issues for whatever reason, the greenhouse gas regulations that you're seeing in the news nowadays, you know, the new regulations that EPA is creating for purposes of coal-fired power plants, those regulations came about through one of these endangerment findings. An environmental group petitioned EPA to find that CO2, carbon dioxide, endangered public health. Once the EPA makes that decision of endangerment, then they're obligated to mitigate whatever pollutant, or in this case, additive to gasoline, is causing that problem. So where we're at today is aromatics are relied upon by refiners as the principal source of octane for their fuels. That's where we are. There's some regulations that exist. We'll talk about that in a moment, but they haven't gone far enough according to recent science. So with that background, let's start with what is the Urban Air Initiative? As had been mentioned, they're a nonprofit organization that... I'm actually going to switch mics here. They are a nonprofit organization that's devoted exclusively to improving transportation fuels, and in turn, that would lead to improved air quality. So that's really the goal of the organization. They're looking to accomplish that goal by looking at three distinct tracks, as I would call them. One is from technical research. The other would be from scientific and health research. The last would be through building a public awareness or coalition campaign, and we'll get into that in a little bit more detail in a moment. At this point, UAI has received support from a pretty broad spectrum of interest groups, individuals, and organizations that represent a variety of interests: health, environmental justice, environmental issues, transportation, agriculture, and the like. So it's a pretty diverse group, but we'd be looking at expanding that. In terms of what their goals are, the long-term goal, and this is a pretty lofty one, but it's to break down the regulatory barriers that currently exist that really prohibit the distribution of higher octane fuels and cleaner burning fuels in the marketplace, and that would include the barriers that exist to distributing higher concentrations of ethanol blended fuels in the marketplace. As I mentioned before, their goal is somewhat different from some of the other ethanol advocacy efforts out there, and this is quite by design, and that goal is to try to do this in a collaborative manner. Many of you may be skeptical to hear that and think that, well, that's a pretty tall order, and I think it is on some levels. But the way to accomplish that would be by building these coalitions that we'll talk about in a moment to bring more voices and perspectives to this debate. Ultimately, of course, the use of these fuels would lead to improved air quality throughout the United States, but primarily in urban areas. In terms of their plan to achieve those goals, they're looking at making their case in three different areas, and they dovetail with the three tracks that I mentioned before. The goal would be to make a case from both a technical and an emissions standpoint that ethanol and higher octane fuels are a better choice and a better octane enhancer than what's currently out there in the market. It is in the use of ethanol as a and higher octane fuels also leads to satisfying quite a few other public policy goals that EPA set out for itself. And again, we'll get to those in just a moment. They also want to make a case from a public health standpoint that ethanol can serve as a very effective replacement for the aromatics that are currently being added to gasoline. And lastly, make that case through a public awareness campaign and through building coalitions of diverse interests that would come forth. And ideally, the plan would be that those diverse interest groups would make the case and demand that the EPA act to improve the fuel that's distributed in the marketplace today. All of those things would be taken to EPA to make this case that it needs to be improved. If we dig into these in a little bit more detail, taking them in order, from a technical standpoint, what UAI does and would continue to do is to work with auto manufacturers, fuel providers, and the like, and really dig into many of the technical details that are out there that underline how EPA regulates these fuels. So this is the work that I know Steve has been doing, and he's spoken to these groups in the past. You've heard him talk about these things. But this is work that actually has to be done. This is looking at the models that EPA uses when they make regulatory decisions as to how they're going to treat ethanol from a regulatory standpoint. What emission factors are they going to use? What are the testing procedures? What are the certification protocols that EPA is going to use? All of those things are very technical. They're very detailed, but they really need to get done. For instance, last week, I think the MOVES model came out, a new version of that. For those of you that aren't aware of it, the MOVES model is a giant black box computer program with all these algorithms in it. You pour data in the front end in terms of the vehicle fleet that might be in a geographic area, how old it is, what type of fuels are going to be used. And out of the back end of that black box come some numbers. Those numbers are the numbers that EPA relies upon when they craft their regulations and make policy. What nobody really sees is what is in that black box, and what is in that black box is critical. That is something that UAI is focused on. Steve, I know, has devoted much of his career to looking at those types of things, and that really does need to continue. From a scientific and a health standpoint, UAI has both conducted and initiated, supported, and compiled information about the health impacts of aromatics when they're combusted in vehicles and what impact that has on the environment in general and on urban communities in particular. Last, and I would think, frankly, most importantly, is building this public awareness campaign and this coalition. We really do need a broad base of support to advance these initiatives that UAI is pursuing. All of this would come together in a collaborative appeal to EPA with a group that would consist of, as I mentioned, that very broad coalition. So let me talk a little bit more about that coalition that I keep coming back to. As I mentioned, UAI has both initiated and has been compiling information that demonstrates that there appears to be a real linkage between aromatics that are used in fuels and the combustion of those aromatics and fuels and an increase in respiratory, neurological, and other health impacts, again, especially in urban environments. They put this information together, and I think it is starting to show that these fuels are responsible for these pollutants causing these health impacts in much the same way as stationary sources. But that really isn't known out in the public right now. The goal of this public awareness campaign and building this coalition is to inform the public, to inform the groups that are out there advocating for improved public health of these new scientific findings, try to bring them into this debate and really get them engaged in this public dialogue about the need to change the composition of fuels. Again, eliminating aromatics, opening the door for the addition of ethanol as the principal octane enhancer. With that said, UAI's plan would be to work very closely with other organizations, those that are focused on environmental justice issues, those that are focused on air quality, and those that are focused on health improvements. Try to pull them together and work with them collaboratively to try to approach EPA to make these changes to the regulations and open the door to higher octane blends, including higher concentrations of ethanol in fuels. And if you think about it, if this campaign were successful, it's really going to bring some new perspectives, some new faces, new voices to this debate that really have been lacking in the past. You know, if you look at the advocacy that's been done to date, at least as an outside observer, there's been very good, strong advocacy that's been done in the context of engaging EPA in rulemaking, engaging EPA in legal challenges and the like. That needs to be done. It's critical that that get done. And like I said, I think organizations that are doing it that I've seen are doing a good job of that. This is something that would supplement that. This is bringing in, as I mentioned, new perspectives into this debate that haven't been there before, and bringing them in based upon information that really isn't part of the mix of the dialogue in front of EPA, right, as it currently exists. Of course, if this were successful, this would get at UAI's goals of cleaner fuels, cleaner air, and again, in particular, in urban environments. UAI would continue to work closely with other organizations that are involved in ethanol advocacy and other advocacy that's related to the missions as defined by UAI. One of them would be the Energy Futures Coalition. EFC has been an organization that UAI has supported in a variety of different contexts over time. And going forward, they would continue to work very closely with UAI. Earlier this year, UAI supported two EFC conferences that were held in D.C. that brought in experts from around the world that focused on the linkage between aromatic compounds and these emissions of not only particulate matter, but ultrafine particulate matter and pollutants known as SOAs, secondary organic aerosols. Those are pollutants you haven't heard a lot about, but it's very apparent that EPA is going to start regulating those types of pollutants in the future. EFC, with the support of UAI, have been bringing more attention to those types of pollutants and the role that aromatics play in their formation. EFC also has a very credible board and support structure. If you've not looked at their website, I'd encourage you to take a look. They have involvement from some very high-profile opinion leaders within their respective fields. We put a couple up here on the slide, several senators. You have John Podesta, advisor to the White House, who's closely affiliated with them, as well as Boyden Gray, former in-house legal counsel for President Bush. So obviously they have quite a bit of clout and is a good partner for UAI. In terms of the advocacy approach UAI would pursue, we're really looking at getting at the core mission of EPA and trying to appeal to that. And what is that? It's common sense. Protecting public health, protecting the environment, and protecting those populations that are a little bit more vulnerable and that really have a difficult time defending their interests. If you look at EPA's website, here's a screenshot under the heading of What Do We Do? You can see that these advocacy approaches and the messages and the mission that we carry forward would focus directly on those big picture goals and directives of EPA. So I think it's a very good fit from that perspective. What messages would be carried? Quite a few. First off, significant new scientific findings show that these aromatics that we've been talking about appear to cause or contribute to an endangerment of public health and welfare, like I mentioned before. This information seems to be new information. It has not been considered by EPA in the past, and that's significant, and we'll get to that in a moment. Importantly, I haven't mentioned this, but it's good to stress. Back in 2007, EPA did make a run at trying to regulate aromatics that are being added to gasoline. They passed what's called the MSAT rule, Mobile Source Air Toxic Rule. Some of you may be familiar with it. At that time, EPA made a decision, a very conscious one, that the only aromatic they were going to focus on would be benzene. And they focused solely on benzene because they thought, their assumption was, that if they forced refiners to remove benzene or limit benzene in fuels, that that would have an ancillary benefit of also driving down other aromatic compounds as well. Over the last 7 years, it's been shown that that just hasn't happened. The overall aromatic content in these fuels really has not gone down much since 2007, if at all. The point of that is it's time for EPA to revisit this, and it's time for them to look at regulating beyond benzene as they had made that decision in 2007. There's other things, legal and factual things associated with that 2007 rule that we think were wrong. Either were wrong at the time, they were improper factual predicates for that rule, or there are assumptions that had been made back in 2007 that I think can be demonstrated to have been proven wrong over the course of time. The point of all that is I think it's time, and we're well positioned to approach EPA and tell them, look, you have to revisit this issue of aromatics and you need to do a more thorough job. Third message that would be carried forth is you can do this. You can reduce aromatics in fuels, and you can do it in a manner that's both technologically and economically feasible. Obviously, ethanol is an option that would be available to replace these aromatics. That is a very credible, technologically feasible, and economically feasible alternative to these aromatic compounds. The other point to make, and this is a critical one, is that they have the legal authority right now to do this. We don't have to have Congress act. Remember I mentioned that back in 1990, Congress had crafted provisions in the Clean Air Act for this very purpose. We're just asking, or our approach would be, to ask EPA to exercise it. Exercise the power that's been given to you by Congress back in 1990 that you failed to do so far. Lastly, the message would be that by regulating aromatics in the manner in which we're suggesting, by removing some of these barriers to using higher octane fuels, which use clean sources of octane, you're also going to be touching upon and resolving a whole host of other public policy issues that you're struggling with right now. So not only will it decrease toxic pollution, it'll decrease coarse particulate matter, it will reduce ultrafine particulate matter, it'll reduce fine particulate matter. It'll reduce the carbon intensity of these fuels. It'll lead to a reduced RVP. The higher octane fuels with cleaner sources of octane, we believe, would result in auto manufacturers making engines designed around that type of fuel prototype, which result in higher gas mileage. And it would also serve to help address some of the environmental justice issues that I know that EPA has been struggling with over time. This is a way to try to reduce the level of toxic pollutants that seem to accumulate in these urban areas where lower-income populations tend to reside, as well as minority populations. They simply can't move out of those areas. So it seems as if this approach could serve quite a few goals that EPA has set for itself. Some of you may be thinking at this point, all right, so why is a lawyer talking to me about all these technical and scientific issues? And the reality is that everything associated with ethanol usage really boils down to being dictated by rules and statutes. It's just the reality that you're dealing with. The corollary of that and the reality of that is you have to find a legal regulatory mechanism to solve these problems. And that's why you have a lawyer in front of you here today to talk about it. I have to say that if you think about the EPA like you'd think about yourself, either personally or professionally, I think that there's some parallels that can be drawn. You know, we all have a lot of things that we want to do. There's a lot of things that we have to do, and we just simply can't get to those as much as we'd like to for a variety of reasons. This initiative, if it were successful, would result in a group, UAI, along with a diverse coalition of other folks, pulling together the technical, scientific, and the health information that would be necessary for EPA to make this decision that these aromatic compounds need to be regulated. Essentially, they'd be doing much of the work for EPA. But equally important is that public awareness campaign in the coalition, because just like us, EPA has limited resources. Building that public awareness campaign and that coalition to approach EPA from a very broad spectrum, I think encourages them to use their limited resources to make this a priority. If that is not done, in my experience, they are simply not going to pay a whole lot of attention to these things, irrespective of the merits of it. So that's why you have public awareness being such a critical component of it. Ultimately, all of these things that I'm talking about have to be put into some type of legal or regulatory context, and that's where the lawyers come in. The way that we would do that is probably putting all this into what's called a petition, which is a fancy word for a very long formal letter to the EPA asking them to take some type of action. So all of this would be put together. We'd do EPA's work for them, and with a very diverse coalition, approach EPA in a collaborative way and say, look, here is the case for regulating these aromatic compounds and increasing the octane content of fuels. That would be filed with them. Once that's filed with them, they would have an obligation to act on that petition, either grant it or deny it. If they granted it, then they're obligated to create the regulatory structure I mentioned. If they deny it, hopefully they won't, but that gives opportunities for perhaps more confrontational advocacy, lawsuits, and the like. But that's not where UAI is hoping to be positioned. That is the component of this strategy that we call the endangerment finding. That's finding that pushing EPA to find that aromatics endanger public health or cause or contribute to an endangerment to public health or welfare. So that's the endangerment component. The other component that we looked at, which we think is critical to resolve, is one that I know you all are familiar with and other groups have talked about, and that's the RVP waiver. As you know, the Clean Air Act, Congress, created a 1 PSI waiver for certain types of ethanol-blended fuels. EPA, over time, has interpreted that provision very narrowly and has essentially taken the position that that PSI waiver would only apply to fuel blends between 9% and 10% ethanol. That has had the practical effect of very much limiting your ability to distribute higher ethanol blends in the marketplace, and that is something that has to be addressed if any of this is going to work. We have taken a fresh look at this in our review, not only of the relevant statutes, and the regulations, but also some of the new scientific information that's out there suggests that EPA has taken a much too narrow view of how they should interpret this provision, this RVP provision. There are other ways that they could interpret that provision in the Clean Air Act, and we think that they're more appropriate interpretations for the EPA, especially given all of the other things that EPA is trying to accomplish with the fuels that they allow in the marketplace. What we would intend to do, UAI that is to approach EPA, again, in a collaborative way, in an effort to explain to them that, look, the way that you've been interpreting this in the past is simply no longer a valid interpretation. Not necessarily saying you've been wrong and trying to bring a legal challenge based upon what it is that they've done in the past, but rather to come to them and present to them what we believe is new scientific information that indicates that as ethanol is blended above roughly that E10 to E12 range, you peak out on the RVP level and you actually ratings, and you actually start reducing when you hit RVP's characteristics of those fuel blends when you hit about E15. So if we were to present that to EPA as new information that they need to consider in the context of what they've historically done in terms of interpreting that provision in the code, that might be enough to convince them that, look, you need to reinterpret this and there's a justification for you to depart from your past interpretation and to open up this RVP waiver to be utilized by higher concentrations of ethanol blended fuels. We would also advocate on these other points. There's enough ethanol out there to accomplish these higher blends. Motor vehicle manufacturers have asked for these higher blends of cleaner octane fuels. And EPA, again, has the authority to do this. There's nothing that Congress has to do. Again, this would probably take the form of some type of legal petition. Again, it would still be collaborative. That's the goal. Wouldn't be confrontational. If this were successful, obviously this would open up the marketplace and the regulatory barriers for ethanol usage quite substantially. So in conclusion, I hope that you understand what it is that UAI is trying to accomplish here, what their goals are, and how they're planning to get there. A couple things that I wanted to stress is, I again believe pretty strongly that if this were pursued, that I think it really has a chance to succeed in ways that are hard to articulate and may seem a little soft to some people. But I do think that this would be a potential. And that would be to have the marketplace recognize the value of your product for things, not just for its octane value, but for the benefit that it has for public health. So let's go back to my mom that's standing in front of that pump. If my mom knew of the hazards that are associated with the aromatics that were in that fuel, I'll guarantee you, I don't care if that cleaner burning fuel was more expensive or not, she would make a conscious decision to buy it. I think the problem right now, and I'll tell you, my mom knows nothing about any of this. And that's really where this public awareness campaign comes in. That if all of this were to succeed, I do think that you would have a segment of the market that would see the value of your product and that would buy it just for that purpose, aside from all the other good technical aspects associated with the product that you all produce. As I mentioned before, I think the work that ACE is doing, the other ethanol groups, the commodity groups are doing to protect the RFS is critical. They're doing a good job. They're doing hard work in that space. And I want to, tip my hat to them. They're doing just a tremendous job, and that needs to continue. And they need to protect that RFS. It has to be done. But if you look at this initiative and you look at the type of advocacy that I'm discussing here, it is meant to complement the work that's going on by these other organizations. And you can see on a broader scale, a longer term horizon, that this type of advocacy transcends the RFS and the regulatory structure that we normally talk about ethanol in, and really is starting to get into the marketplace a little bit more. It's trying to counteract some of the negative criticisms that are out there about your fuel that the oil industry is starting to advance and have been for quite some time. I do think this is the opportunity and the mechanism to accomplish that. Why? Because it really does bring in groups that aren't normally associated with this debate. The reason being is saving lives, protecting public health, transcends interests in ethanol. Everybody, or most organizations out there, can support that. That's something they understand. That's something they can very much get behind. If that can be done, those groups essentially at some point would become viral. I mean, you've seen some of these environmental groups, these health groups and environmental justice groups, what they've done. They can be self-sustaining and they can go out and they can really do grassroots campaigns, and you can leverage this initial investment in this effort in ways that I don't think you can through other advocacy efforts. But all of this at this point really has to start with you all. It has to start with the ethanol industry as the base. You all are the catalyst to really get this effort. It's underway, but to keep it going and to expand it into the ways, into the type of activities that I just described. Once that takes off and we start getting these other more diverse groups in, that's when it'll really go. Oops. So if you look here, these are the organizations that have expressed support for the type of activities that UAI has staked out, for the type of messages that they've been sending in the marketplace to date, and for the type of work that they've been doing. This is a very good start. But again, the next phase would be to bring in some of those interests out there that are more aligned with health, environmental issues, air quality, and environmental justice. That would be the next phase. So with that, I'm going to give it back to Steve. He's got a couple more things to share with you. And then we can take questions if you have any.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
I just want to cover a few areas that we're working to support the message, the work, and the activities as we work with the autos and other groups. So by the end of this month, we hope to announce to everyone fixourfuel.com. And it is a interactive website where you can start asking the supporters to even write letters to the EPA or to Congress. So we're hoping that'll go live here in about 3 to 4 weeks, maybe the first week of September. But that's to educate people on the dangers of aromatics. So hopefully you'll see something on that. We're also working on some technical research areas. We have a fourth paper with Ford and GM under peer review. This one is about blending fuels and how that impacts emissions, primarily in vehicle testing. All right, I didn't do that, I promise. We have some work going on at a local university in Kansas looking at density questions, how we evaluate fuel compatibility. We're working with the Fuels Institute that's started by the National Convenience Store Association, and we're always collecting real-world data of whether it's vehicle performance or fuel data as it relates to winter, summer, high, low octane, or vapor pressure. We also have a website under design, fuelingthetruth. That's actually supposed to be .info. We're hoping that once this goes interactive, this is where you can send your dealerships, sales, technicians, small engine issues, octane questions, the value of octane. We really feel that in the years to come, and this is being proactive, you're going to hear a lot more about the value of octane when you purchase a new vehicle. You're going to see more response to octane as the auto industry continues to do downsizing and other things. So we're hoping that that website will be very valuable to our industry, and we would like to work with other groups like ACE. We had talked about it. How do we put very positive data or stories and information there, but keep it very fact-based? With that, I mean, our goals are that the auto industry wins. They are asking for octane. They asked for it in Tier 3 last year. They continue to look at fuel quality issues. We would benefit the EPA with this by reducing particulates, one of the key areas. Interestingly enough, we didn't learn about the health issues of particulates reading health studies. We learned it by reading automotive studies. The auto industry is concerned about this. One is just the health aspect, but two is the future regulations. So we're not discovering something new, but it's interesting. We learned a lot from just the auto industry. We're providing a pathway for a higher octane and a value for our fuel, and I believe the consumer will win because a lot of vehicles in the future, and even some today, would not see any mileage penalty on an E20 or an E30 as we start to develop, you know, premium recommended vehicles to start hitting the marketplace. So we're just, we need your help. This is going to take some effort to bring on the coalition building. That's why we're here. That's going to be a big focus as we put together the technical data. We would like your help to share these websites like Fix Our Fuel and Fueling the Facts, info.info, and educate your community and local, your local community and your employees, and just start the grassroots. And that's the things that we believe we need your help as we are trying to move this forward.